The Community Character Hour is brought to you in part by the generous support of Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. Thanks to Lori, Clem, and all of you for supporting community radio in North Idaho. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson. Last month, we spent time with Edward L. Bonner. E.L. Bonner. And one of the threads we touched on was Bonner as a ferryman. And that feels like the perfect place to begin today, because if you start following the stories of ferries in early Bonner County, you very quickly find yourself in the world of another remarkable family, the Markhams. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. What have we got today, Hannah?
So this is an excerpt from Melvin, known as Cap, Markham's obituary in the Sandpoint News Bulletin on December 8th, 1951. The boyhood of Markham was everything the young boys of today dream about in the way of adventure. It was a common occurrence to find the tracks of cougar around the door, Markham said once, and recalling his early years at Laclede. Besides his nine brothers and sisters, young Melvin's only playmates were the children of Indians who frequently camped in the meadows along the Pendre River near the homestead.
Welcome to the Community Character Hour here on KRFY. I'm joined once again by Hannah Combs, Executive Director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, Director Emeritus. Today, they bring us a story that ties family, ferries, and boat building together in a way that brings early life in Bonner County to life vividly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't even imagine. Truly a magical childhood.
Yeah. The tracks of a cougar around the door. Is this poetic license or is this...
as we will learn, Cap was a very good storyteller, but okay. I would not be surprised if this was true on at least one occasion.
I would think so.
That would definitely give me the chills waking up to that in the morning.
Yeah.
The true wilds. But at this point, ferries were lifelines to the people of Bonner County. So they moved people, supplies, livestock, mail, news, and all practical things that made settlement possible. They connected one side of the river to the other before bridges and paved roads changed the rhythm of daily life. So today we're going to go back to that famous river crossing that we had talked about before, the Senawakatine. So think about the days of the Wild Horse Trail across the Pendre River to Laclede. And we're going to meet one of the most memorable rivermen in local history, Melvin Cap Markham. So Cap is a nickname.
Yes.
Not the middle name. Mm-hmm.
And we assume it's because he was a captain, not for a cap he wore on his head, although maybe he had some good hats as well.
I know. We got to dig up that story.
So this is the very same man whose obituary we just shared from. And his obituary was titled Colorful Pioneer Boat Builder to Take Final Cruise. So there's your poetic license, Jack. Mm-hmm. The ferryman, hunter, riverman, and storyteller was described as having a presence that lingered in the memory of the people who knew him. You can imagine him standing there, an unforgettable figure wearing buckskins, a wide hat, there's his hat, a heavy watch chain, a pipe, and a revolver. So all the accessories. The way he is remembered upon his death, his peers seem to think of him as someone who not only lived through the early era of North Idaho, but embodied it. Revisiting who Cap was opened up a much larger family story. While fascinating on his own, he also gives us a doorway into the Markhams as one of the foundational families in the Laclede and Senawakatine area.
So the earliest Markham tied to this story is Lyman Markham. So he's one of the first white settlers in that stretch of the Pend'Oreille River. So he operated the ferry at Senawakatine, which later became tied to Laclede. And he traded with native people, ran the crossing and established a foothold there before any permanent settlers take shape. Then his brother Francis arrived with his wife Elmina and their children. And that's where the family story becomes unusually vivid, because Elmina later gave a firsthand written account of what it was like to enter into this country. So she remembered arriving in Sandpoint by train in 1883 and then having to reach the homestead by rowboat. Ugh, this is one of my favorite stories. There was no road on the sides of the river, so that kind of sets the stage here.
Yeah, and that rowboat leaked badly. That detail appears in multiple versions of this story. As she tells it, the children were scared, the boat kept taking on water, and the oldest son, Melvin, later called Cap, had to keep bailing out the boat while the adults worked to settle the family, to calm them down and get them safely downriver. Elmina said they kept the little ones calm by talking about the trees along the riverbank. And I think, if I'm remembering correctly, when I was reading this account, they said it took about 7 hours to get downstream from Sandpoint to Laclede. So I don't know if they were just being really careful, hugging the shoreline as the because the boat was so leaky, but it seems like a long time.
Midwater. I also, when I first read that and throughout the years, the story has transformed in my mind that it was like really dark out too.
Yeah, I imagine it is dark, but if they were talking about the trees, it must have been. See, yeah. This is how the stories evolve and become legends.
Yeah, and then the cougar's on the sideline, and then the Pend'Oreille paddler comes up.
But we know that the children were scared. They were bailing out the boat and trying to distract the kids talking about the trees.
I've had that happen.
Yeah?
Yeah, like a boat taking on water.
Ooh, that's scary.
Yeah, with a little child.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were rescued by Canadians, and they were lovely.
Nice. Yeah, I've been in one boat where just the engine stalled out and we couldn't move, and there was a little kid on board, and it is crazy how much that intensifies the moment when you're like, I can maybe swim. I'll hopefully get through this. But when there's like a little one, you just have to figure out a way.
Let's see. See, 7 hours, that seems about right to me for Sandpoint to Laclede.
In a rowboat.
Yeah, right. That's the thing. Without a motor and without even sail.
Yeah.
That's a long paddle. What is that, 10 miles more?
I guess we forget 10, how 15? Far that
yeah,
actually
it's,
is.
It's a ways. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, that's like an all-day paddle, I think.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Hence the dark. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe it was by the time they got there.
Well, right. Yeah, you'd think there. I don't know. As soon as you notice the leak, wouldn't you kind of think, well, maybe we should try this again tomorrow and go back and fix the leak?
But, so at this point, so this is 1883, the railroad into Sandpoint was just finished.
Yeah.
So there's not much there yet. And it's certainly not a place where there are families.
Yeah.
So I think the only people there are maybe a couple merchants and
a brothel,
like some boarding houses full of railroad workers. And then a giant forest.
It's like, I'll take the leaking rowboat.
Yeah.
A careful calculation of risk in this situation.
But I like that boats are immediately front and center in this guy's story. As soon as, I mean, is the day that they arrive, they're in a boat, a leaking boat that he's got to take care of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the one bailing it out.
Yeah. Okay. How unusual is it to have that kind of firsthand account from a woman settler in that period?
It's genuinely rare. Most of what survives from frontier settlement is institutional. So things like land records, ferry licenses, we talked about that in the last episode, minutes from commissioners' meetings. Written accounts are, it's it's hard for those to survive the generations already.
Mm-hmm.
And then a woman's written account of daily life in her own voice with that level of detail and feeling communicated, it's not common. It's one of the reasons that these types of primary documents are so valuable to our historical record, because otherwise, you know, there might be some mention of Markham filed for homestead claim, 1887 or something, but no mention of what their experience was like.
Right.
Getting there and building it.
And I think that's what's so important, whether it's a memoir or like those diaries, it's so important. I think about today with technology and emails and how we're communicating. And I was talking to my 12-year-old about this. I was like, but how are we going to remember what you're saying?
Yeah. And even with that, you know, like as we're seeing Elmina and Cap, this family seems to be a family of storytellers who know how to tell a great story in writing. But that's also why at the museum we collect oral histories, which is where you do an audio recording with someone, because people tend to, it's easier for people to get into storytelling mode when they are telling a story verbally to someone who's listening intently. And so that's why those parts of our records, they may not be as, you know, factual all of the time. Sometimes we can exaggerate or elaborate on the details or not remember things perfectly, but it's what brings these moments of history to life.
Well, certainly magical. And Elmina describes such a clear vision of how isolated they were. She mentions that they never saw white people nearer than Sandpoint, and they were there for months without seeing another white woman. And she described how glad she was when one finally appeared on a fishing trip. And Francis, her husband, joked that the poor woman left quickly because she was afraid Elmina would talk her to death. So it's a funny line, but it also tells you something real about those first years, you know, that she felt.
Yeah, that's an important point, because settlement history is often told through what was built. So you learn about the roads, the ferries, the trading posts. Elmina's account reminds us that settlement also meant women who were working out how to make a home, raise children in an unfamiliar place, manage their isolation when they didn't understand kind of the local language, and how they built relationships from scratch. So her voice gives us access to what daily life would have actually felt like, not just what was constructed around them.
That isolation must, I mean, it's almost unimaginable today.
Yeah.
You can't put yourself, I mean, you can't even think of what situation that we might have experienced could compare. Because there's no way that you can imagine being that disconnected from everything else.
Yeah, we're overloaded with communication now.
Yeah.
But the idea that you were just in the woods with your own family and like no one else whose language you could speak. I think you'd have to have a pretty stout constitution, mental constitution too, to get through that.
Most certainly.
So daily life was organized around the river, it sounds like.
Yeah, the river was everything. That is how you transported goods, how you got supplies. It was the source of your income. It was typically how you ran into other people. And of course, it is the element of the geography that's ever present. The ferry that they operated was the center of it for this family, and the Markham family maintained that crossing for years. Melvin grew up, it feels odd calling him Melvin, Cap, grew up working the river, watching the river, and learning from it. So it makes complete sense that he would later become so at home on the water.
But before we get to Cap as an adult, there's a layer of the story that needs its own attention. So the relationship between the Markhams and the native people who had long used the Senawakatina as a crossing and campground. So Amina describes Kalispell and the other native families camping nearby, arriving by bark canoe or on horseback, holding church services with a priest, So she was frightened at first, but then because it was so unfamiliar, but over time she learned how to communicate and found the women very friendly. So that shift in her account is significant. It shows both the settler fear and the reality of everyday contact.
Hmm. Yeah, and Sunny Aquitaine at this point was not just empty land waiting to be settled. It was an established crossing and gathering place with a long history of native use. The Markham Ferry didn't appear out of nowhere either. It was placed within an older landscape of travel and movement. And remember, this crossing had been used consistently by white missionaries, miners, and increasingly sort of industrialists for 20 to 40 years at this point. But by the 1880s, with the Markham family settling there, there was no question that the settler presence on this native camping site had become a permanent fixture.
Yeah. And this is Sunny Aquitaine across the river from Laclede now.
Yes.
And that was, just for our listeners' benefit, it's no longer in use, but that was basically the main site of northwest crossing of the Pendre River. Yeah. In between, any, you know, in North Idaho, the next closest place mm-hmm. would have been, I don't even know.
Yeah, yeah. Remember when we were talking in earlier episodes about kind of establishing these big trails through the Northwest? Mm-hmm. If you were trying to get from Spokane or Walla Walla or even Portland into Canada or into Montana, this was a crossing point that most people traveling through the area used.
Yeah.
To it was kind of an easier route through the mountains.
I always think of, I grew up with horses and the woods, you know, surrounding me, and I'd hop on my horse bareback and I would go on the deer trails because that was just like the easiest way to traverse. Mm-hmm. And that's how I believe all of these trails were established. It was always like the easiest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Best like traveled.
The animals.
They
kind
started.
Of had a trail, and then the native people would get, yeah, mm-hmm. because yeah. it's the easiest trail to follow. They'd follow
lowest
that.
Water.
It would mm-hmm. become more established. Then as the, you know, pioneer settlers are coming in, they're like, oh, there's a trail here already. That must be the best way to get mm-hmm. through. Like, it's just
naturally
these layers
occurs.
Of reusing and then expanding
yeah.
the path that's already there.
But Hannah, you were saying, or well, both of you were saying that this was, that their interaction with the native people who were already there was a big feature of the early years of the Markham family. Are there any accounts of conflict with the native people, between settlers and native people in the Sunny Aquitaine area? Or
that's
in this area?
A really great question, Jack. There was one incident where Francis wanted native families to move their horses off of, quote unquote, his meadow because he needed the hay for the cattle. The situation escalated and a gun was drawn. Hmm. Young Melvin came out with his own gun. And then according to the accounts, an older native woman saw what was happening. She started talking rapidly. I imagine like her hands are in the air, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the standoff ended without violence. So it's a tense story. It reflects the conflict, the dynamics, the fear, and the fragile negotiation that defined frontier life in this period. I have to say that this actually happens in Boundary County all the time. Like still, so.
The like, sort of like
literally
property disputes,
the gun on the like hip,
uh-huh.
like the tense words. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no joke.
Yeah. And again, like I think we've mentioned a couple times that the longer the family was there, the more they started learning of the Salish language.
Mm-hmm.
But especially if this was early on, it would have been hard to communicate.
Right. Like, what are boundaries?
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that's a, was there like a plat that they like settled on?
Yeah. I believe they did file a homestead claim, but it might have been a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know that they had the land office really established until the late 1880s. I might be wrong on that. But in those early, early years, there was quite a bit of people basically, you know, from a legal standpoint, squatting mm-hmm. on land and then applying for a homestead deed later on once they could kind of file the paperwork and whatnot. So it was, you know, it yeah. was very gray at this point in time.
Absolutely. So he was still a boy, Cap, at this moment.
Yeah. When in the
this the is conflict right after the Native
yeah. Americans. Yeah.
So growing up in a place where he's learning multiple languages, watching how people move through the land and learning to read the river and seeing first how quickly everyday life could become intense. Mm-hmm. So it's a fascinating time for Cap.
And he did learn to, they did learn the language to some extent. They learned the native tongue.
So yeah. he did. Okay. And in Elmina's account, it says that she learned enough to kind of banter with some of the native women. I don't know that she ever became fluent. Mm-hmm. And there's no clear indication that any of the other family members really learned the languages. But we know that Cap was interested and he wound up doing quite a bit of business with the local tribes. And mm-hmm. so he did learn the language pretty fluently. One account says he learned what he called the flathead tongue fluently enough to interpret at their family's trading post there at Seniaquatine. Mm-hmm. His early immersion in the language shaped him. He was not only listening to the languages around him, but learning them to the point of being able to conduct business with the tribes. Hmm.
And what's happening elsewhere during those years in the community besides at the Markham homestead? What is this time period like?
Well, things are slowly taking shape. You have more homesteaders that are arriving, families coming in. There's a need for teachers, a school district. So I'm going to change some names now. Mm-hmm. Elmina, that's such an interesting name. You don't hear it very often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hired Lewis Carter to teach the children and later hired a daughter of the Long family as students grew in numbers. So the first school month was actually held in the family's log house because the schoolhouse wasn't quite finished yet.
And so, at mm-hmm. this point, there's, I think within about 10 years, there are maybe 6 or 7, that might be a little high, at least 4 or 5 other families in the area.
Which is amazing. Yeah. So you think like you're a mom, you're trying to homeschool these children. Mm-hmm. She wants to create a co-op, right?
Yeah.
So that's amazing, though, thinking about the determination behind it. But mm-hmm. a bigger goal than just a co-op, like we need a school district. So the family comes into an isolated place, so they survive the first hard years, and then they insist on the school. So they also insist on Sunday school. They need mail. So all these things that turn a single family settlement plot into a community. And it's a very deliberate project at this point. It's not about survival. Mm-hmm. So they definitely had, you know, a vision and...
And I think they're a couple years ahead of Sandpoint at this point. It took a little bit longer for Sandpoint to get those kind of, you know, civic institutions in place. Mm-hmm. So Elmina said she was as proud of that first cedar log school as people later were of brick or stone buildings. Their investment in that effort may not have been grand, but it made a real impact on the families trickling into the area.
How does that connect to the kind of person that Cap Markham becomes?
Well, he grew up in a family that built ferry crossing, roads, schools, and trading posts, and even a community. And so that building instinct was in everything around him from a very young age. And he eventually found his own medium, and his medium turned out to be the water.
So is it time to talk about the grown-up Cap Markham? Who is he as an adult? What do the accounts say about Cap Markham?
Well, every account stresses that once seen, he was seldom forgotten. He's described as tall and lean, only slightly touched by age, even late in life. dressed in buckskins he made himself, wearing moccasins he made himself, carrying a large pipe. Am I remembering correctly, Heather, that he made his pipes himself?
He did.
As well? Okay.
Wow.
And the rifles, like the, yeah. all of the woodwork on he the did. Rifles.
Wow. So he has his buckskins, moccasins, pipe, a hunting knife, and a gun. It mentions that he carried the gun by permit. So at this point, we must have kind of the law established in the area if he's actually getting a firearm
permit.
So
what do you think? Like 20s, 30s now?
I mean, this could even still be just a little after 1900.
Interesting.
Yeah. He had a pretty long life, and he died in 1951.
Okay.
So, yeah, he's in his, I think he was 14 or 15 when they came down the river in 83.
That's like a full-blown adult, like, get married.
Right, yeah, yeah, at that time.
When are you having kids?
One writer remembered that he was fascinated by compasses. Another noted that he had a particular watch chain he was very fond of.
Huh.
Several mentioned that he seemed to leave a trail of stories behind him wherever he went.
Oh, I love that. Mm-hmm. He's also remembered as one of the three Markhams called Captain, which tells you how deeply boat work was embedded in this family. So I imagine, I'd like to think it was the leaky boat. Right? Mm-hmm. They're like, we're never going to have that happen again. We're going to learn how to build boats. Mm-hmm. But Cap becomes the most prominent of them. So he goes well beyond the ferry into lake navigation, towing, passenger service, mail service, boat building, and work across Priest Lake as well as Lake Ponderé and the river.
I feel like this is kind of the perfect illustration of life in North Idaho. People are drawn to this area. They love the beauty of the surroundings, and it's really hard to make a living here, but you just figure it out.
Yeah.
And so you have people like Cap who are like, what do you need? I'll do anything. So he'll tow you across the lake. He'll build you a boat.
A lot of side hustles.
Yeah. So yeah. many different side hustles just to like be able to maintain that life here in Bonner County.
So what boats did he build? And what are like, yeah, what, give me some examples of what, of these different boats and different jobs that he did.
Yeah. So he held the steamer mail run from Hope to Bayview on the boat called the Mountain Belle.
Okay, that would have been like the most beautiful mail run ever.
Right?
So you can't even imagine in the morning.
Your boat's full of bags of mail. Oh, it's quiet. So it's peaceful. There are eagles, probably mountain goats. You're just, I like to imagine that he never stopped appreciating the beauty of it.
And I guarantee you he saw like the orbs and the green lights.
Yeah.
We'll save that for our October episode.
Well,
come on.
You know, I mean, okay, that, yes, you're describing a beautiful, calm morning on the east side of the lake, but I'm guessing that is not always the way it is.
That's true. Also notorious for storms.
Yeah.
And so he had to be a really savvy boatman.
Yeah.
To be able to get, because that, I mean, if you're running the mail
on a steamboat.
Don't they say it's the mail, it never fails?
Like, yeah.
That's the reputation they want to maintain. And so if there's a storm, you don't get a day off. You have to muster through it.
We should remind the Postal Service about that.
So
bring that back.
Yeah. Do you know anything more about the mail run from Hope to Bayview? Like how often that went? Was it year round or was it just...
Yeah,
seasonal,
and it's actually really cool. There is still a mail run from Bayview to some of the little towns on the east side of the lake.
So right.
Lakeview, Granite. Mm-hmm. And so they still take the mail out there by boat,
amazing,
even in the winter. I believe that this mail run would have run every day.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So... And remember, at that point in time, nobody was sending emails. So all of your communication took place over the mail. It would be hard to tell because of the population increase today. But I'm guessing there probably was still more male scent at this period of time than there is today. And by that, I mean not junk mail, but like actual correspondence. So, yeah, so that was a big job and one that held a lot of responsibility. He also towed log booms to lumber mills. So this is where you would basically, a log boom is a huge collection of cut timber that is floating on the lake. And they basically create a chain where they chain logs together to create kind of a lasso around this big group of logs. And then that would be chained to a tugboat. I find this incredible that a tugboat, which many of them weren't huge, like a 40-foot boat maybe, could tug thousands and thousands and thousands of trees across the surface of the water. I just find that amazing. So he did a lot of tugging of the log booms to the lumber mills. He also built some of the tugboats that he was using. So he built the Elmina, named after his mother, and another boat called the Coyote. And if you visit the History Museum, we have the anchor from the Coyote outside on the lawn. And that will give you kind of a sense of scale of these boats. It's quite large, actually. Cap also worked with the Humbird Lumber Company and is especially associated with a stern wheeler called the Juno. He later built the Tyee, often described as the first large towboat on Priest Lake. And that's probably, there were two Tyees. Those are probably the boats he's most closely associated with in people's memory. And he was also connected to the Northern Navigation Company.
And all these boats that you're describing sound like working boats, not... These aren't boats for pleasure. It's not a houseboat. This is something he's trying to make a living at. So he was pretty instrumental in the economic development of the area, would you say?
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to look at it. So logging, freight, passengers, mail, all that industrial supply. So the economy of this region moved by water. And these boats were how... It all moved. So Cap's career is a reminder that boats were the infrastructure. A lot of what got built here depended on the reliable movement of people and all of the goods moving around the water.
And ferries were part of a much wider regional system of movement and connection, too. The Markhams help show how that system worked at the level of family life, daily work, and long-term settlement.
Well, what do the records tell us about the Séné-Aquitaine ferry itself over time? How does that evolve?
The county records are actually quite detailed. So the ferry goes by different names at different points. It was originally called the Haynes Ferry, then the Markham family, and the Laclede Ferry. County commissioner records show ferrymen being appointed, their wages being agreed upon and set, bonds posted over the ferries, and repairs that they paid for. One entry records Cap Markham being paid to raise the ferry, so after it sunk, probably after ice damage. Over time, the county takes formal responsibility for the crossing, and it becomes a public service rather than just a family operation.
Probably after what they saw with E.L. Bonner. Amazing. And while the completion of the Sandpoint Wagon Bridge in 1910 changes the ferry's role, it doesn't end it. It continues serving people on the south side of the river, and it became especially important when the bridge was closed or difficult to use. One account describes a day in 1950 when a bridge closure sent far more vehicles than usual to the ferry in a single day. So it's still actively used decades after the bridge opens. Just consider it a plan B.
Yeah. I think we shared one story at some point about the south end of the Long Bridge just like I can't remember what caused it, but catching fire. And so like the last 20 feet of the bridge burnt. And then just think about the detours we have to take today around construction. If the Long Bridge was out of commission, you had to travel to at least Seniaquatine to the ferry. And if you didn't take that stop, you had to go all the way out to Priest River. And I don't even remember when that bridge was built. I think it was a while later. Yeah. So there were limited options to get around.
The bridge does not then just replace the ferry when it's built. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jack. And that's worth understanding clearly. Roads, bridges, ferries, rail, they overlap and interact for years. So the ferry keeps serving a local function that the bridge doesn't cover. Local people use what works, and what works is often several things at once.
It's also probably inconvenient for some people to drive all the way to Sandpoint to cross the river. If you're one of the people located a little closer by, I'm just just imagining what that might be. What other reasons you might take the ferry instead of the bridge? Let's see. Well, what about danger on the ferry? Were there serious accidents at the ferry crossing?
Yes. The record is actually pretty sobering. There are several accounts of cars rolling off the ferry in the 1920s. Some incidents were fatal. One involved young people returning from a picnic. Of course, there's a famous one about a doctor going to tend to a sick patient and his car rolling off and him and his nurse dying. And just remember, like at this point, automobiles are brand new. So there are they don't have many safety features yet. And then the combination of that with the ferry and kind of some of the operational things that could go wrong there, it was pretty risky. Ferrying was demanding. It was tied closely to the weather. Currents could at times be unpredictable. There could be ice. They ran the ferries at night, so the darkness added another dangerous element. And, you know, like all things, sometimes the equipment could fail too.
And that is why it's so important to have a skilled ferryman and boatman. So moving a loaded platform across a river isn't simple. It requires judgment about conditions and how to change things quickly. So the men did it really well and kept it well for a very long time. I love we'll get into the archives at the museum that really helps support this story, but it's the photos of the horses and the carriages and the cars and everything that would have been packed on that ferry and moved across. It's just mind-blowing.
Right. Yeah. And that is interesting. Just like the things that we choose to take photographs of at different points in time, because, you know, back then it was difficult. Like photography was, you couldn't do it on a phone, you know, you had to get film developed and so forth. So it's always kind of interesting to me that people were taking photos of, you know, a horse wagon loaded on a ferry boat. And why would they take that photo? But today it's so helpful to us to understand how things worked.
And I remember the caption of that particular one, because that one comes to mind too. It's such a fascinating photo. They were moving like a whole household.
Yeah.
So maybe it was like a prolific time in their life.
And
they're like, smile.
Yeah. Or they're like, just in case it all sinks, we can send the photo to the insurance agent.
Which would be the Farman family.
You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson here with Heather Upton and Hannah Combs. And we're talking about the Markham family, Cap Markham in particular, Melvin Cap Markham, a important figure in the late 19th and early 20th century in our area. Beyond his reputation as a boatman, how is he remembered personally? And was he like, I think that's it. This kind of goes into his reputation as a boatman a little bit too. Was he a reliable, Was he the guy? Was he the boat operator who you turned to if you needed a boat? Or was he in competition with others? Or I don't know.
That's a good question. And again, think about how big Lake Pend'Oreille is. Yeah. If you tried to boat in a motorboat from one end of the lake to the other today, that would be a whole day excursion. So back then, the lake probably felt even bigger when you are having to cross it by these more like, I mean, I guess the tugboats and whatnot, those had engines in them at that point, but it's a big lake. And so I'm guessing at different kind of ports of call, there would be kind of the go-to guy. But as we said, Cap seemed to be everywhere. So he was working out of Bayview, out of Hope, out of Priest Lake, out of Sunny Aquitaine. He kind of seemed to take on whatever job was available. And so, yes, I would think he was kind of the guy that even most if trusted. You hadn't worked with him, you knew of him, and he had a pretty solid reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I'm thinking of, okay, he's running the mail run from Hope to Bayview.
Yeah.
But this would have been after his days operating the ferry, or he had an interest in both at the same time. He couldn't do both, I don't think. It seems like that would be all day going to the the mail run.
Yeah. I kind of see, from what I've read of him, I see him as sort of the the seasonal worker.
Yeah.
And we still see that today, where it's like in the winter, you do maybe you're like cutting ice out of the lake. In the summer, you're taking the mail boat. In the fall, you're kind of working with the elements and picking up whatever jobs can be done at whatever time of year. So he probably wasn't doing, multiple of these jobs in one day, but throughout the year, maybe he had 10 or 12 different jobs that he did as they were needed.
I think we still see that in this area, which is amazing. Multiple side hustles. You see your friends up at Schweitzer, and then they're helping you at the local, garden store, during the spring summertime.
And yeah.
It's really fun. I think that's what's so neat about this area.
Yeah.
The diversity of roles.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay. But tell me about Cap Markham, his personal life, I guess, beyond just the business.
Yeah. Again, we already talked about, his appearance, his pipes, his guns, his moccasins, his fascination with compasses. We don't have much written in Cap's own voice, but he strikes me as a person who is just really curious about everything around him. So he doesn't necessarily have to learn the Salish language, but he's interested in it and he wants to be able to communicate with the native people. He doesn't have to make his own clothes, but he wants to learn how to do that. He doesn't have to learn how to be a mechanic on every possible different type of boat in the area, but he figures it out. He seems to have this kind of like curious tinkerer's mind. One writer noted that he would spend his kind of downtime carefully polishing his guns, but he was never actually known to shoot one. And I find that really fascinating too. Yeah. He just seems to like to know how things work.
Yeah. Like a builder and a collector. In fact, with every boat that he built, he actually had a model which detailed it, which was really interesting. And he whittled that model. And even at age 77, he was still known to be hewing a keel from a tamarack tree.
Wow.
It's incredible. So whether it's exact, the consistent picture is someone who remains like in his physical working relationship with boats and wood in his entire life. So he wasn't just reminiscing about it. He was actually still doing it until he really couldn't anymore. Huge passion.
And he knew something about how Whiskey Rock got its name. Is that correct?
There are many stories about Whiskey Rock. As his story goes, in the 1890s, Cap and three prospectors were stranded by a storm near Lakeview and had to wait 3 days for the wind to drop.
In the 1890s.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was, I don't know if it was this year, but in 1893, there was this huge storm. They said like 8-foot swells just like took out everything along the Hope shoreline. So I don't know if it was that storm, but that's kind of the intensity of the storms that could hit the lake.
Yeah. So, yeah. And I'm thinking, I mean, the 1890s, this is before the town of Sandpoint formally exists. This is...
And very early on, before it officially
the government exists, anyway yes. officially exists. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean there's people in the area, but this is very early days, and this is they're over on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
So they are,
which is already notorious for windy trips,
and they are way out there in the in the woods on the big lake, or on the wild side of the big lake, and they are.
If you know where Whiskey Rock Campground is today, it's about halfway down on the east side. And according to Cap, these four stranded men, all they had to sustain them through these 3 days was a single bottle of whiskey. So this may or may not be the definitive origin story, but it's the kind of story that attaches itself to a landscape through a specific person's recollection. So the place and the person become linked in memory.
I love it. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm going to roll with that one.
I'm just imagining four people with no food, cold, wet, trying to get through. They're huddled obviously together. Unprepared for an overnight, much less 3 days stranded there, and they have one bottle of whiskey. I just wonder, you know, were they politely taking tiny sips and passing it around, or were they like doing some sort of contest to be like, whoever can swim around the bay gets the whiskey? I don't know.
I think there were a lot of stories being shared, huddled together. And it's stories like that you were mentioning, Hannah, earlier about like memory, folklore. There might be some facts that tell us how communities want to be remembered, both in place and in people, and how it really kind of sets the landscape. And that, I think this would maybe be a good time to mention, when I did that exhibit by way of water, it was absolutely incredible. So we had the photos, and then we had the incredible oral histories from Almina and the other accounts. And then the family generously donated most of Cap Markham's artifacts, boat building tools. And so all of a sudden you walk into the museum and you become like immersed in really understanding the family, because you can feel and see. Well, you can't feel.
Well, okay. I will say, as like someone going in the morning and just kind of making sure the exhibits are tidy, that exhibit is incredible. And you have an entire metal chest full of Cap's tools there on the floor. And there is this piece of chain kind of draped over it. are a couple times I've been in there like, oh, the chain fell onto the floor. I need to pick that back up and set it back in its place.
Wait, here it is. Are you saying that the chain has moved?
Yes.
And the firsthand account. So you're saying,
are you saying that the spirit of Cap is messing with me?
Yeah. Hannah says that like she never has experienced anything. I think we have an experiencer.
Interpret it as you will. But I would say that having to lift that chain.
Yes, it's heavy.
Definitely put me in a better understanding of what his life would have been like, because this is only a, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 foot long length of chain. But each of the links is about an inch in diameter. It is so incredibly heavy.
I think he's talking to you every
morning. Imagine the strength because you would need to do
this. I put that chain on that trunk and it never came off. So I don't, like, you can't move it. It's a flat trunk. So that is definitely going to be more an October show.
Well, he's a mischievous one then. But yeah, so definitely put you in.
Yeah, so make sure to go to the museum, see that exhibit.
Don't
if the chain pick moves.
Up the chain.
How about what was his personal life like? Was he a bachelor, or what's he? What is he? What was
well?
Yeah. Was he a family man?
Well, he was born in Oregon.
Okay.
And the family moved to this region before he was grown. So he was married first to Addie and later to Myrtle, who comes up often in his later recollections. So Myrtle rode the tug with him at times. They had two children, Elsie and Melvin Jr. There were also family notes about siblings and other tragedies. So the materials don't spell out everything, but loss is a part of his background, unfortunately. Hmm. And by the 20th century, the broader Markham family had dispersed widely. So we see them going to Seattle, Michigan, Montana, and Alaska.
And yet, Sunny Aqua Teen remains the anchor of their family. Elmina is buried there. Cap is buried there, too.
I think he was her favorite. I'm sorry, but, like, they're buried together. There was the boat named after her.
Yeah, yeah. A nice, close relationship. After Cap moved to Seattle, accounts say Lake Pendere remained what he called his true love. He came back in the summers visiting relatives and old acquaintances. The place seemed to have a hold on him that didn't loosen.
And he moved to Seattle in his retirement sort of? Okay. Mm-hmm. But he kept coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even after he had moved away to this area.
So I think Cap bridged two very different worlds. So he was born in Oregon, grew up on a frontier river crossing, worked through the era of boating and logging, and lived long enough to seem almost out of time to the people that he met, which I think, you know, he really learned how to immerse himself in that native world and kind of find out who he was at a really young age. So I imagine he's not like your typical, you know, everyday classic individual that's homesteading. So the 1951 article about him understood that he captures someone who seemed to carry an older world behind with him.
That kind of surprises me that he moved to Seattle in his retirement. I could see how it would be kind of strange when you were so instrumental in sort of building the world that became settled Bonner County. By the 1950s, you know, that world is completely different than the one that he was so pivotal in creating. And I would think a lot of people in that situation might be like, oh, back in my day, you know, in the good old days, things were so different, and kind of like getting stuck in nostalgia. But instead, he's moving to Seattle. We don't exactly know why. Maybe it was to live with one of his kids, but to this place that's even more, you know, booming, big, like has kind of modern stuff going on. And I don't know, I guess we're deep into speculation now, but I do very much see him as someone who's just always so interested in the world around him. Mm-hmm. So kind of seeing every step of life as a new adventure.
What did Seattle think of him, I guess, would be the question, you know, with his buckskin clothes that he made himself and his moccasins
and the huge pipe and the hunting knife.
Yeah.
He's got a permit for this gun.
Exactly. And he's like,
I see him in like the rocking chair, like whittling. And he's just that kind of eccentric guy that the grandkids like run around and it's hard to say. I do think it's probably healthcare and family over in Seattle.
You'd kind of think so. Mm-hmm. He really, those early days compared to the world that he would have been surrounded by when he passed in 1951, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the what was going on here at that time, and just in the West and in the world in general. What a different life than what he grew up with.
And I guess that's true for everyone. I mean, I think of like my grandmother who was born in like early 1930s. You know, what has she seen in her 90 something years on earth? I think that's kind of what happens to all of us if we're lucky enough to become old.
Absolutely. And the importance of like sharing and storytelling and Because you have some people that like to share a lot. And it sounds like Cap would have been one of them. But then, like, my parents sometimes will be like, well, I don't really have anything interesting. And I'm like, no, you're really interesting.
Yeah. Everyone has a story worth telling.
Yeah. And an experience. And that's all a really important part of history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good, you know, I think this story shows us that how local history survives. Mm-hmm. And it is in those kind of fragments of what we tell.
Yeah.
So a newspaper clipping here, a family note there, a typed up reminiscence. We do have those, you know, county commissioner records, photographs. None of them are complete on their own, but together they can build this incredible story. So
absolutely,
our work is in connecting the fragments back to each other and to context. Mm-hmm. We're not just preserving objects. We're trying to preserve the relationships between them.
And the beauty about making sure, too, that, like, you're documenting your story and those special things in your life and donating them to the museum, too, I think is, like, really special and impactful. And this story also shows why collaboration across institutions matters. So there are Bonner County threads running through this, but people's lives typically don't stay neatly inside county lines. People move, waterways connect communities that don't share a border, and we have to look outward to discover a fuller, richer story.
Hmm. You know, you were just talking about the different kind of primary documents that you go back for, that you have to look through to kind of piece together a story or an early history. What's the experience like with of working with those early those primary materials?
It's wonderful. That's what keeps it going. It can be difficult. So digging through handwritten notes, written in cursive, which we're learning, you know, not everyone can read anymore. Half legible copies of copies, documents that have been photocopied so many times that the edges are missing. But that's part of it. You can feel generations of people trying to save these stories before they disappear. So there's a sort of chain of care behind what we have in our archives at the museum.
Hmm. And when you're putting together an exhibit, it becomes really immersive. The museum does such a great job cataloging all of the artifacts, but I tended to go actually into all the hallways and, like, physically looking and kind of feeling all of the objects, and that they all kind of start to blink at you and come to life, and they all have, like, a spirit and a story, and it's magical when you can put them all together and show them off.
Yeah.
Our time grows short once again. What do you want listeners to take away here from the what is the meaning? What can we take from the life of Cap Markham?
Ah, oh, so much. They would definitely be at my fictitious dinner party, of course.
The Markham family, yeah.
Oh, they're incredible. Mm-hmm. So really, that fairies were not just transportation. They were the structural core of the early community and life of this region, the point where movement, trade, settlement, and connection all came together, and that one family can carry an entire regional history, settlement, native contact, trade, school, mail, boats, logging, industry, and memory. The Markhams give you a thread that runs through most of it.
I'd add that local characters matter more than they are sometimes given credit for. History often gets taught as dates and systems, which are really important ways to give context to history. But Cap Markham makes early Bonner County sort of tangible in a way that a timeline can't. He gives it a face, a voice, a pipe, a boat. That's how an era becomes something people can actually feel and connect to.
We've been talking today with Heather Upton and Hannah Combs about the Markham family, the early settlement at Laclede and Seine-Aquitaine, and Melvin Cap Markham, one of the notable rivermen of Bonner County history. A story that begins with a leaking rowboat and opens onto a wider picture of how this region was built and connected by water. Well, Hannah, Heather, thank you both. And thanks to all of you listeners for being here for the Community Character Hour on KRFY. This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere, and it's 9 o'clock. But real quick, should we let folks know what's going on at the museum coming up? It's a very busy time.
It is. And yeah. Right before that, I just want to give a shout out to Dan Evans, who helps support some of the research with steamboats. And he's just such an incredible local historian. And we're just so grateful for his help with this episode.
Well, thank you, Dan. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, coming up at the museum, tomorrow night is the Historical Society's annual meeting at the Hive, starting at 5 o'clock, followed by a special presentation by guest lecturer Jack Nisbet, renowned author. You don't want to miss it. He's going to be talking, sharing stories from an upcoming collection of essays about birds. I'm so excited for that. And then...
He was a guest on this program once. We went down and talked to him in Spokane. And, yeah, I could just listen to him talk about any subject at all for... Hours. And that's what we did. We went down to interview him for one specific thing, and I think we ended up recording 2 hours of conversation with him on everything.
He's definitely like a regional celebrity.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Okay. So if you're listening to this show live on April 27th, that's tomorrow night, April 28th at the Hive.
Saturday, we have a big day. Not only is it free for Saturday and hands-on history at the museum, but we are also doing our first drive and discover tour. This is a driving tour of historic sites along the north and south shores of the Pondere River. You will get a little map. You'll get to drive around. There will be people at each site to tell you about the history of those places. That's from 10 to 4 this coming Saturday, May 2nd.
Does that include a stop in the Seine-Aquitaine area?
It does. We will have a stop set up at the Seine-Aquitaine cemetery. And then on the way around, you can drive down to the Seine-Aquitaine ferry site or the Laclede ferry site on the other side of the river and check that out as well. That evening, again, May 2nd, Leadership Sandpoint is hosting a local history trivia night as a fundraiser for the museum. That's going to be from 4 to 7 at the Sandpoint Organic Agriculture Center. You can learn more about that at the Greater Sandpoint Chamber of Commerce website. And then, of course, KRFY and the History Museum are both participating in the community-wide Live Give 7B fundraiser next week, May 4th through 7th. So go out and support your favorite local nonprofit there.
Yeah.
At 7bgives.org.
There it is. Yeah. Like you said, KRFY is also participating in that, but so are dozens of.
I want to say about 75 nonprofits.
That's what I
think. It's incredible.
That's the figure that I'm thinking of too. Yeah. Okay. All of them participating in this cool event from the 4th through the 7th of May, and then a wrap up on the 8th. Okay. That's it, folks. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We got to get out of here. It's 9:05. Thanks for listening to the Community Character Hour. Stay tuned for Bird Note and Autos Eclectic Mix coming up all day long after that.